The First Nations Major Project Coalition suggests there's $575 billion worth of transactions in the queue with their 134 nations that are participants in that. The Assembly of First Nations suggests there's a $349.2 billion gap on infrastructure in Canada alone. We're not even talking housing yet, right? So the opportunity is massive. And like I said, you've got none of the risks that are typical of emerging markets.
Welcome to the Future in Sound podcast. I'm your host, Jen Wilson. This is a podcast where we talk about prioritizing people, planet, and profit. In each episode, we speak with world-leading experts who help us see the future we want and our role in it. This is episode 22, Indigenous Investment. Fred de Blasio is a proud member of the Huron-Wendat Nation and co-founder, managing partner, and chief executive officer of Longhouse Capital Partners. Prior to co-founding Longhouse, Fred served as executive vice president for the Squamish Nations Development Corporation with $1.4 billion in development. Fred is an experienced executive with a proven track record at AT&T, TELUS, and NVIDIA Technologies, where he had a $300 million exit. He also has extensive experience in mergers and acquisitions with over $100 billion of deals, corporate development, and marketing. Fred, it is such a pleasure to have you on the Future in Sound podcast. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
So, Fred, I'm really curious to hear more about how you have moved into a really important space of investing in Indigenous businesses. What's your approach and how did you get here in your career?
That's a loaded question because I'll try to be brief, but I had the great good fortune of studying at Cambridge, and that's when I really got sort of the imagination got captured by sustainable development. So I did my master's thesis on that. Went to Wall Street, which was a bit of a weird and shocking place to be because, you know, I certainly believe in, perhaps because I'm Canadian, I believe in sort of a compassionate capitalism. And I don't think you get that everywhere in the world and certainly not on Wall Street. So I moved into large corporates where I felt, you know, telecommunications was a bit more aligned with what I wanted to do with my life. But I never lost sight of my indigeneity. I'm here on Wendat. My nation's just outside of Quebec City, though I grew up in Montreal. And so I set up some things when I was at TELUS and other organizations, you know, related to ESG, though we were calling it the environmental issues, et cetera. And then through a friend, I was invited to this event where I learned how to give an inconvenient truth. So I was one of 200 Canadians chosen to give the Al Gore, you know, Oscar-winning presentation, which is a movie. And so it was it's always been a passion, and it's so intimately linked to my heritage, particularly on my mother's side, with respect to the seven sacred teaching, love and courage and respect and truth, humility, and you know, like, you know, there's a five, but there's two more. And the point being that you respect Mother Earth. It's a systemic approach to life, right? Everything has an interplay. And so, and that really was foundational in terms of my interest in everything I was doing. And then I gave back to the community by, you know, I got fortunate. I sold one of my startups to AT&T in the U.S. And so that afforded me a little bit of the luxury of choice, which we don't always get. And so I decided to give back to my Indigenous community, and I worked for a nation in their ECDEF group, and that was really important. But I also felt I could have a bigger impact.
What's an ECDEF group?
Oh, sorry. An economic development group. So in Canada, First Nations often, you know, are a political body, and they set up economic development corporations in order to sort of foment business relationships and businesses in general. And it's a way to sort of separate church and state, if you will, from an economic standpoint. So the business of business versus the business of politics, if you will. And so that culminated in financing for a huge development in downtown Vancouver called Sanoc for the Squamish Nation. That was a $1.4 billion dollar financing we did. And while I was there, you know, I was like, wow, we need to do something more. Like, I'm helping one nation, but I felt the need to help more. And I had a fairly unique skill set in terms of my background in as an Indigenous person. We barely index, in finance. And by barely indexing, there's 19,000 CFAs in Canada. There's only 5 that self-identify as Indigenous. So the lack of literacy, the lack of financial acumen, and importantly, because of, you know, Canada ratifying the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, particularly Article 32.2, which is really relates to free, prior, and informed consent, I felt it was critical to take my financial skill set and apply it in what was taking place in Canada and help a vast number of nations as they sought to exercise their rights and finally have a seat at the finance table. And we have all read the newspaper stories where someone wins $50 million only to find themselves destitute and, you know, homeless 3 years later. And after having fought so hard, our elders have fought so hard to finally get to the United Nations Declaration becoming the law of the land, I thought to myself, well, I certainly cannot. I wouldn't be able to live with myself if I didn't use my skill set, which was so appropriate for this, the times. And I'm standing on the shoulders of giants that came ahead of me. And our elders were incredibly wise in making sure we trained lawyers historically to sort of fight within the system, if you will, because it has been a fight. And so I'm trying to do my little part to make sure we put an emphasis on financial literacy and financial acumen, because I really don't want to be the homeless person, or find our nations as the homeless people yet again. You know, we fought so hard. And so that's been sort of the journey. Long-winded answer, but, you know, there is a thread that follows through. And I've always liked building businesses, you know, and so this is an important, it's the legacy element of my career. You know, we're raising $1 billion fund in infrastructure specifically to assist First Nations and their economic development corporations to have a seat at the table and make equity investments to 50% or higher in the projects that cut across Indigenous ancestral and reserve lands in Canada. So there, I'll take a deep breath because I've been chewing your ear off, Jennifer, but that's how it all sort of fell along. That's the waterfall, if you will.
What an incredible story. And I'm really interested to hear. So when did you make the decision or know that this was the direction you'd go? Were you, you know, on Wall Street thinking, I've been thinking about the sustainable development goals and, you know, this just isn't matching it? Or, you know, was it really when you sold a business and you thought, wow, I could really have a ton of options. Let me look at this. Like, when did the idea start to really take root for you?
I'd have to tell you that I've always been a bit restless in every job, just because, you know, again, going back to the compassionate capitalism, I've always felt like there was something missing. While I had some, you know, wonderful experiences, I had the great good fortune of running a big chunk of the TELUS consumer solutions business, and which was a ton of fun. But I like things, think about things holistically. And there was a part of my being that wasn't being satiated, in terms of what I was doing. And so the opportunity to help, Indigenous people, my people, to use my skill set and put those two things together and advance reconciliation was something I just, I had to do. And so I have an extra spring in my step because of it. And what I like to say and is that, you know, sometimes reconciliation gets a bad rap. People go, oh, more woke BS. And what I tell people is it's an opportunity. And I look at it as a renaissance. So, you know, reconciliation to the rescue is renaissance, right? That's really what this is about. It's about massive opportunities to empower and lend a helping hand. And who hasn't had a helping hand? This is not about handouts. This is about let's share knowledge. We have knowledge of the land. We have knowledge of Mother Earth. We have, the world will be in a far far better place if ancestral knowledge had actually been listened to. And we didn't have the science to prove it, but it's interestingly now science is proving everything we've been saying for millennia. So, you know, it was just this confluence of events, this restlessness about, you know, there has to be more to what I'm doing. And a woman in history too, right? I mean, there was an exogenous factor when the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People became the law 2 years ago. That, and while interpretive, just set a different context. Now, I'd also tell you that business leaders, pension plan managers, aren't as well versed in what that means. And that's something that we have to do a better job of educating the business community on, that we, you know, we're open for business and we want to be partners. And there's a huge opportunity in infrastructure in Canada. McKinsey suggests there's a $200 billion renewables infrastructure gap in Canada through to 2030. So when you think of total addressable market, that's just a section of what's needed. And so, you know, when I like to do large businesses with big ideas, and so it was important that there had to be a trillion plus dollar market for me to get pretty excited. And so this, you know, it was a confluence of events. Like, you know, you have a legal framework that changes that's going to upset all of the inertia. You've got a huge total addressable market. You've got something you could feel really good by helping people who've been so disadvantaged, and I've been fortunate not to be disadvantaged. And so, you know, it's one of those things where it was the perfect good storm, you know.
What a beautiful way to channel restlessness. One of the things so we have an international audience for this podcast, and so there are a couple things I'd just love to get your, just a couple thoughts or, you know, a wider explanation on, you know, how we think about reconciliation in Canada, and also how, you know, the UN development has really, you know, changed the game, because you shared that as, you know, part of the story on your end.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's unfortunate because we're at a time in history where all these international institutions seem to be ignored or ignored is probably the best way. There are worse words, but we'll stay with ignored. And there has been it's fantastic work that's been done, and my elders always say we have to say the full word, the full name. So it's the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is one of those manifest improvements to the global approach to dealing with Indigenous peoples. And so, you know, it's a shame that we're seeing some of that influence or, you know, being on the wane rather than on the growth. And that's because, you know, well, the geopolitical issues certainly give rise to that and sort of the recession of liberal democracies, unfortunately. So, you know, I think from our standpoint, as Indigenous peoples, we have an opportunity to really help. You know, if you help build First Nations, you're helping build the nation of Kanata, which is the original word for Canada. And that's good for everybody. And this is a tide that lifts all boats, all canoes, I should say, perhaps. And so, you know, when I think of how to move that even more rapidly, I think of global pools of capital entering into, you know, into Canada. And what's really interesting is I was with one of the large Maple 8 pension plans, and one of the fellows, I think it was a fellow, yeah, it was Adam, said, "Wow, I didn't realize that the world's largest emerging market opportunity actually was right here in Canada." And, you know, given it's an international audience, you know, it's really important that we get the message out that Canada's open for business. If you work with Indigenous peoples, given the strictures of the Indian Act, we actually are in control of entitlements on our land, which means we can get approvals for projects much more rapidly than you would otherwise get. But we need capital. We need a lot of capital. I addressed the $200 billion, and that's just in renewables. So when you look at other transmission lines that are required, all based on hydropower, you look at wind power on the north coast of Quebec. Canada's open for business. We have a stable government, a relatively stable currency. So You have all of the inherent upside of emerging markets with none of the downside risk, right? And the geopolitical issues, you know, we're pretty safe on Turtle Island, right? So you know, I'd encourage folks to really look at Canada and look to deploy capital here. I think the foreign direct investment in this country would be a very powerful tool and provide, you know, outstanding returns. And I encourage the pension plans who in Canada who have historically sort of, certainly in the last decade, sort of been going outside of the country, I'd say, hey, you know, take a look at Canada because there's so much in our own backyard here. And you know, I always draw attention to the fact that there's a very simple mission that pension plans have, right, which is to deliver superior risk-adjusted returns in the best without undue risk and in the best interests of contributors and beneficiaries. And so when I see pension plans open up in different, you know, countries, I always scratch my head because did they forget the best interests of contributors and beneficiaries or the people who live in Canada? And so if our infrastructure is dilapidated, if we're not investing in housing, that's impacting the best interests of the contributors and beneficiaries. And so, you know, it's a bit of a call to action to pension plans in this country to really focus on Canada, because that's how you're going to really help with the best interests of the contributors and beneficiaries.
And it's interesting when we look at some of the trends with limited partners who are investing in private equity firms, ESG has been all over the headlines for the past 3 to 4 years, recently with some interesting headlines that maybe we can get into. But it's often when I ask, you know, a general partner, what is it that's really pushing you to be interested in sustainability? It's, well, our limited partners are pushing us. So I'm wondering, when you turn your mind to some of the trends in sustainable investment or ESG, how does that tie in to what you're doing differently?
Well, you know, we have the good fortune of being Indigenous, and so we lead with our values. And when you lead with your values, I often tell people in panels or in meetings, like ESG is just, you know, the co-option of what our Severn Sacred teachings are, right? And so we think of it problems holistically. But there's a real marriage between ESG and what First Nations can do to move the yardsticks. We happen to live on a territory that has vast mineral resources that are going to be required. Maybe we have 32, I think, of the 34 whatever critical minerals, and so working in concert with First Nations, with our understanding of the land and the land stewardship we've done since time immemorial, really provides an opportunity to really walk the walk and talk the talk, you know, in a way that helps everybody. So if you want to do a wind turbine, well, guess what? You need the special magnets and you need the critical minerals that exist in Canada. And geopolitically, it's good for our, you know, our OECD partners or certainly our G7 partners because, you know, frankly, China's backyard is now Africa. They've, you know, with Belt and Road Initiative, they've locked up a lot of the critical minerals. Russia's a bad actor on the stage, not dissimilar from China, and so Canada is one of those unique places. And given the legal framework, given the volition of the First Nations to participate and be active partners, and given our volition in our culture to always share knowledge, I think we are incredibly well positioned to deal with proponents globally who want to come in and understand that approach. And so long as they come in with a lean-in approach, like tell us more about, you know, your Indigenous culture and your values and sharing that knowledge, you know, I think Canada should be an economic leader, and we will never be a military might, but it seems right now, geopolitically, there's really only two ways you can get anyone to pay attention to you. It's either you can flex nuclear muscles or you can flex economic muscles, and I'd submit to your audience that Canada is supremely well positioned to flex its economic muscles. There are some systemic changes that need to occur. We need to streamline some of the approval processes, but, you know, we have all of the necessary raw materials. We have a developed services economy. We have a group of people who are highly educated and capable, who understand big business, who understand that you know, our unique brand of capitalism, which is that compassionate piece, is really key. And so, you know, I think it represents such a massive opportunity, and it's all going to be wrapped in ESG. We have, you know, in our fund, we've got a pipeline that's got over $3 billion, and we just stopped adding to it because it's like, okay, there's too many, and we haven't, you know, finished the fundraise, so we've got to slow that down, so we've got to stop priming the pump a little bit. But you know, the First Nations Major Project Coalition suggests there's $575 billion worth of transactions in the queue with 134 nations that are participants in that. The Assembly of First Nations suggests there's a $349.2 billion gap on infrastructure in Canada alone. We're not even talking housing yet, right? So the opportunity is massive. And like I said, you've got none of the risks that are typical of emerging markets.
It's really interesting because, you know, hearing, you know, initially we started talking about, you know, the financial literacy and some of the goals and sort of educating potential portcos or communities where those portcos are working or investments are working. And it really strikes me that there's also the opportunity for cross-pollination. So working with those communities and sort of at a fund level, being leading in terms of, you know, Indigenous engagement, Indigenous principles, and then perhaps that also influencing the LP point of view, which is interesting and not often something that's really considered. I don't know if that seems like an outlandish view, but...
No. We made a commitment from the very beginning that we would never lose sight of our values and that we were going to make that a distinct part of our value proposition. And to that end, we gifted to 12 First Nations 5%. And your readers, or your listeners rather, are going to be going, wow, these guys are crazy. But we gifted 5% of the GP interest to 12 First Nations. We gifted 5% of the care. And we also committed to spending 5% of our time in the mentorship piece. And that's important to make sure that that literacy curve trends in the right way. And recognizing that any of the proponents that come in, you know, if they come in with that spirit, a spirit of knowledge sharing, will really have a positive impact. And I think they're going to learn so much. My life has been massively enriched by my culture and the approach we take. The prism through which we look at life is vastly different. And I remember when I was a kid, I'm not much of a hunter because it just, maybe I'm just too sensitive, but I did hunt frogs because for frogs' legs. But, you know, my mom very early told me, you know, you only kill the ones that are big enough that you can eat and try to avoid killing the females so that they can reproduce. And so, you know, I'd come back with, you know, out of my canoe with a bag full of frogs' legs and we would eat all the frogs' legs. So, you enrich life when you can share, but you also have respect for Mother Earth and all of her gifts. I think the beauty, too, is that proponents can have an opportunity to really help build capacity and skills for First Nations, in engaging in these partnerships. I think the approach is really key, and we're proud of our 555 pledge. And you know, the more LPs and GPs that sort of understand that, and I think maybe we can have that spread through the entire community, right? Because it's good business too, right? And you can feel good every day about what you're doing.
And that's really interesting. I'm wondering, because of course, with other funds, you know, they're probably, we have a couple private equity listeners that I know are going to be tuning into this and thinking, how can I apply some of these ideas to my fund? The 555 is a great example. Are there any other principles? You know, you've spent time with colleagues, you know, in private equity. Are there any other principles that you would recommend or that, you know, might help others to adopt some of the lenses that you grew up with and you're applying now?
So, well, one of the other things that's intimately linked to the 555 pledge is what we refer to as the SIM program, the scholarship, internship, and mentorship. So all the partners are contributing dollars for scholarships for Indigenous people. You know, I mentioned I went to a great school and it changes your worldview. And so that's an important, the scholarship piece and making sure that we education sort of is at the front end of life so that you can go on to lead the most full life you possibly can. But another area we're really keen on is it's really tough to get into finance unless you have those summer internships, whether it's with a GP or an LP or any type of financial institution. So we're really big on promoting that internship, but it's not exclusive to Longhouse. What we do is we use our extensive network in New York, London, Toronto, Montreal, and to some a lesser extent, but also in Vancouver, to find Indigenous kids and give them those opportunities, that there is such a thing as finance for good. That is something that, that it is a creative industry. You know, Indigenous people, you know, all do a lot of art. And so I always try to frame finance as one of the most creative industries you can get into. I've done, you know, deal structures can be very unique. Solving problems with finance is something that, that has, that can deliver on positive outcomes. And if there's one thing we know in finance, we drive capital, and we also have to drive trust. And so that's part of the internship piece. And of course, the mentorship is that ongoing participation. So, you know, I had the great luxury of recruiting a couple of Squamish kids that I, you know, and while I'm no longer at Anishinaabe, the Economic Development Corporation of the Squamish Nation, I still mentor them, you know, and that's an incredibly rewarding thing. And so, you know, I think when you give back, you get so much more in return. It's almost unfair, and it's a habit like anything else. You know, at first it may feel weird, it may feel like, why am I doing this? But I'm proud to say that there's massively positive impacts, and you know, the future is really in the hands of the youth. And so it's important that we mentor, we share our values, and also keep an open mind to learning from them.
My final question for you, Fred, is just a question around, now it can be a book, it can be an article, but a question that I love to ask guests on the podcast is, you know, has there been a particular, you know, book, article, you can even share an experience that's really framed the way you think in your career and has led you to where you are?
Yeah, I mean, there's countless books, I countless stories in my culture, and maybe the simplest is a story. At a young age, I had the good fortune of someone seeing a little sparkle in my eye and sort of taking that mentorship approach with me. Not to get too personal, but my father suffered from early onset Alzheimer's. And so, you know, I lost him at a very young age, and I didn't have that sort of that mentor, that father figure. And thankfully, I had a very, very powerful and strong mom who is just phenomenal. And you know, my culture is matrilineal, so I'm still very close to her. But, you know, she was able to mentor me in a way and share, I guess, you know, help me develop my feminine side. And I think that's something that fills you out as a human, right? It's you know, you've got your buddies, but and I didn't have the benefit of a dad, but a very powerful and bright shining woman named Diane, my mom, who helped guide me and you know, was my lodestar, if you will. And so you know, I owe so much to her. She's the one who really helped me through the tough times, who helped guide me, and who was my unwavering support through you know, look, everybody has challenges in their our journey, and so I'd say it was her guidance and counsel and unwavering support. So less of a story, more a little bit shout out to my mom, but she certainly deserves it.
So. I'm smiling from ear to ear. What an amazing story. Fred, thank you so much for joining the Future and Sound podcast.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Jennifer. Really appreciate it.
Thank you to Fred for joining us. You can learn more about his work by checking out the links in the episode description or by visiting re.co.com/thefutureinsound. The Future in Sound podcast is written and hosted by Jen Wilson and produced by Chris Attaway. This podcast is brought to you by Rico, a software as a services company helping clients achieve resilient competitive advantage in the long term. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to tell a friend about it. And if you have a moment, rate us in your podcast app. Until next time, thanks for listening.